Günstig ohne App. Bei Aldi gibt es einen Preis für alle. Diese Woche Bio-Joghurt mit Crispy Müsli, 150 Gramm für nur 89 Cent. Oder Iglo-Rahmspinat, 750 Gramm für nur 1,69 Euro. Entdecke weitere Angebote in deinem Aldi Nord. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 28, Episode 13. Coming up on this show, we've got how Aleister Crowley inspired the Beatles, phantom fondlers of the 1970s, and the tulpa cults of the rich and powerful. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
If it wasn't for that last part of the 1970s, you could assume that the phantom fondling has some connection to Aleister Crowley.
Well, you would, yes, you would assume, naturally. And I think we will probably find a connection somehow. This is the thing with Aleister Crowley, there's this kind of inside joke that he's involved with every major conspiracy in some way. It's like 6 degrees of Aleister Crowley. He's connected to everything in some way.
How did you end up getting to Aleister Crowley stuff today?
There's a great new special issue of New Dawn. You know how they do those, they have their latest issue, which comes out, you know, every month. But they do these special issues which focus on one particular topic.
Yeah, they're fantastic.
Their new one is amazing. Every single article that's in there, almost every single article, would be a great segment for the show. They're talking about the harmonic grid with Bruce Cathy, which is amazing. There's an article on spirituality in Russia and how it's changed over history. There's one on ancient dreams and technology and weird tech tights found in Australia. And there's also an article right towards the back, which I found really intriguing, on this conspiracy with the Beatles. And I don't know if you are familiar with this, because I know you're not a Beatles fan, but back in the 60s, there was a conspiracy that Paul McCartney was dead and a double had taken his place to keep the band going. And there's all this symbology associated with some of the album covers, and there's all these clues with how this took place. And apparently at the time, Western media actually hounded him, like tracked him down on his farm in Scotland to try and squash the rumors. But there's always been this idea.
There's always something that's outlying.
There's always this idea that it was all like a hoax, and well, not that it was a hoax, but he's basically this double that's replaced the real Paul McCartney. And amazingly, there's a connection with Aleister Crowley to all of this. And there's a suggestion that a lot of this is some kind of occult ritual. It's all inspired by Crowley. And recently, a bunch of old photographs were released from the, you know, the Sgt. Pepper's album cover.
Yes, yeah.
There is a
cult symbology in that, apparently.
Yeah, I'll go through all that later. But yeah, these new photos have been released from some archive somewhere. They're never before seen photos. And they're basically the process of how this album cover was created. And it goes through the setup of how they made the stage, how they put all the different cutout figures behind the Beatles. And in the album cover, the Beatles are standing in front of a bunch of the famous people on the cover. And because these photos have been released for the first time in history, we now know the individuals that were standing behind the Beatles.
Please don't tell me that Crowley or someone connected to him was.
Those individuals reveal a clue that connects Crowley to this conspiracy of Paul McCartney being dead and replaced by a double.
Okay.
It's really crazy.
I mean, you got me in. Well, I ended up coming across some stuff that aligns with Crowley, but not directly. But it is strange that you should happen to pick out that particular article, because only recently we've been talking about this idea of, you know, ritual being this kind of backwards nonsense idea that if you perform some type of ritual to connect with the spirit world or to, you know, make your life better in some magical way, that it's completely absurd and completely outrageous. But as it turns out, ritual actually plays such a vital role, and even the most hardened, you know, scientifically minded person, without even realizing it,
it's something. Well, we all do rituals every day.
We all do rituals, and it all has ultimately this goal of improving our life. It's a way about humanity somehow connecting with this hidden force that allows us to lead a better life. A really great example, it sounds silly, right? But a really great example is, what is the ritual that drives you to get up at 5 o'clock every morning and go for a run? Like, that in itself is a ritual, because you get up, you're not only getting the physical effects from it, you're getting the psychological effects from it. It's a ritual of a sort. And some people, though, where it crosses into this kind of wild, you know, that's preposterous and that's you know, outrageous, is the idea that you can utilize certain rituals, certain practices, to be able to influence the fabric of the reality that's around us.
Did I mention this to you recently? Because I started doing a book called Ritual, and I backed out of it because it ultimately wasn't really show material.
No, you haven't.
It was by Dimitri Zagalatis. I think I did mention it on the show very briefly.
Oh, maybe you did.
But yeah, this guy was writing about Ritual, but it's purely from a scientific point of view that it's like evolutionary biology.
Yeah.
And he starts off talking about this Greek island of Tinos in the Aegean Sea. And every single year, these... pilgrims go there, and they like normal tourists will get off the ferry that takes you to this island, and you know, you'll jump off and you'll go sightseeing. But other people that arrive at the island will start crawling, dragging themselves along the road, and there'll be hundreds of them, and they'll just be like, like dragging themselves, like old ladies in their 70s, dragging themselves across the pavement under the hot sun. And what they're trying to do is get to this old church that's right on top of this hill where the village is. But the way he describes it is because they're dragging themselves across the pavement, they've got like blood coming from their elbows, their skin, they're all sunburnt, you know, they're parched. And they finally get to the top, and that's like a huge ordeal. It takes half the day to do it, and they've got family members helping them and everything. And they get to the top and they basically do a little prayer and that's the end. But his whole thing was, when he asked them why they do it, they're like, oh, I don't know, we've always done it. And this is the thing he found with rituals. Every time he asked someone who was, that's right, we were talking about firewalking.
Yes, yeah.
He had someone that all he did was firewalking. It was his whole, like his father did it, his grandfather did it, and his grandfather's grandfather did it. And when this researcher asked him, well, why do you do it? He was like, I don't know, we've always done it.
Yeah.
They didn't understand, but it was the ritual gave them meaning, it gave them focus, it was like a spiritual path for them. So yeah, it's in everything.
It's absolutely in everything. It's like, you know, hygiene, for example, is a ritualistic practice in some way. Like, you follow the same routine every single day. When people break into happy birthday, everyone knows the happy birthday. It's like this celebration, this celebratory ritual that's surrounding a particular event. And what some people have described ritual as being, as a way that, because human beings, even though we have, you know, the concept of time, without looking at clocks, it's kind of like time is this ambiguous kind of thing for us. So for us to be able to put a marker in the reality of our lives, we perform these rituals. So it's like every Christmas, you know, you cook in a certain way, or you play the same songs or something like that. We get into this ritualistic kind of way that allows us to kind of harness ourselves into this current reality. But then you cross into things that do become more crazy, like I had mentioned. And this is where you start crossing into the idea that you can practice certain rituals, you can do certain things that allow you to change the nature of your reality. And that can be relatively benign. They can start off with things like The Secret, for example. In a way, that in itself is a ritual, by trying to manifest. And this is what a lot of ritual is. When you start looking into more occult avenues of ritual, it's about manifesting things into your life that are beneficial.
I remember why I pulled out of that ritual book. It's because the author very early on presupposes that ritual is purely this magical thinking. It has no demonstrable effect in the world. It's just people doing things for the sake of doing things, and it doesn't actually have any tangible effect, which we don't agree with.
I don't agree with that at all. It's totally absurd. And in fact, this particular episode is going to focus on really, you know, kind of a critical analysis, a synthesis, if you will, of stories out there, which, look, they're kind of stories which are very difficult to back up, but they give us a scene. They show us that there are people that are in the know, that are very wealthy, that are very powerful, that utilize ritual to significantly impact the reality that we live in. And not just themselves, but everyone else around them. They use ritual to be able to attain great power and great wealth. They're the two things that people go for.
Are you going to do Megan Fox's blood rituals?
No, I'm not going. It's funny that that kind of stuff comes up, though, because
it's so hot right now.
Well, it's just not
drinking
hot at all.
Other people's blood.
It's like, that's
the hottest thing out.
Well, you know, when you described that story, though, I'm pleased you did, of people that were dragging themselves up that hill and were, you know, scalding themselves and were cutting themselves and getting, you know, scabs and obviously open wounds, that crosses into this really weird trend that does show up through occult rituals, dark occult rituals for summoning entities. There has to be a release of blood. This is this really weird element that comes up in many of these stories. And this is why you start finding that ritual is connected to, well, obviously there was the satanic panic of the 1980s and 1990s that went across the US, and there were so many, you know, television shows that were reporting on the satanic panic of there being satanic blood cults that are around. But according to some sources, which I'll go into in a moment, there are claims that no, actually there were satanic groups that were performing these rituals that they had pulled from, you know, ancient texts, and they were sharing them around and they were utilizing it to try and summon certain entities.
Well, just because it's a panic doesn't mean it wasn't happening to some degree.
Well, exactly. And strangely enough, one of the biggest ones that shows up, of course, is cattle mutilations. And cattle mutilations are highly unusual in themselves. Like, there's always these elements that are attached to it where people kind of tend to lean towards the idea that it's extraterrestrial. And the reason for that is because you have it that, well, normally there's no blood left in the carcass. There seems to be incisions and the removal of, you know, of vital organs that are surgically precise. They have a laser-like burn in them. The other big factor that comes from cattle mutilations, which people lean towards the idea of it being extraterrestrial, is that the animal seems to have been dropped from a great height. It's been lifted up and then it's been dropped back down. But there might be more to it than that. It might actually be that there are some type of cults, satanic cults, that are participating in some type of ritual for the purpose of obtaining those materials. Because it's not the cattle mutilation itself, that's not the ritual. It's obtaining the materials in a certain way so they can use them for other rituals later on. And there were people that had come forward and claimed that they were involved in these satanic cults that were performing cattle mutilations.
Really?
Yeah, so I'll come back to that. But let me set the scene for you of just describing how it's funny, because it's from a very, you know, a scientific way of thinking. This was published by Hal Hirschfield. He's a PhD, and this was published in Psychology Today. And he points out that, you know, back in 2006, there was kind of this little joke going around that there was a professional baseball player by the name of Nomar Garciaparra. And he had this elaborate ritual every time he would step up to the plate. He'd adjust his red armband on the right arm. He'd tap the home plate with a bat. He'd touch his helmet with the bat. Then he'd go back to the helmet build. Then he would, you know, cross over his shoulder. And then he'd yank the batting glove on his left hand. And then his right hand would go over his leg. All this really detailed ritual. And he would repeat it four times at least. Now, this guy could potentially be suffering from some undiagnosed obsessive compulsive disorder, but that doesn't necessarily seem to be the case, because when asked, because obviously it got people's attention, it was quite obvious he was doing this. He was like, well, why do you do this? And he's like, oh, I've just always done this since Little League. And when I did it in Little League, I only did it twice. So I was a poor batter. But since I do it four times, it seems to work. And when they said, well, this is a ritual of some kind, he's like, no. I'm not
they
superstitious.
They don't believe it's a ritual.
No. He's like, it's not a ritual. I'm not superstitious. I'm just making sure that I'm going through these motions to make sure that everything is tight.
Dude, can I read you Rafael Nadal's ritual?
Oh, please. Yes.
It's mind-blowing. Okay, so this is what he does every single match. Obviously, one of the greatest tennis players of all time.
He's only just recently retired, didn't he?
Did he announce it?
I think he just recently retired.
Okay, I haven't been following. But this is what he has done. Before every match, he takes a freezing cold shower. When he arrives at the stadium, he enters the court holding a racket in his hand, and he takes great care not to step on the lines, crossing each line right foot first. Very important that he does that. He then places his bag on the bench and turns his tournament ID face up. His chair must be perpendicular to the sideline, perfectly perpendicular. As he prepares for his warm-up, he makes the game officials wait for him. During the warm-up routine, which must be performed facing the crowd, he removes his jacket while jumping up and down. This does not deviate for every single match he's ever done. He then takes an energy gel, opens it carefully, consumes the energy gel, and then in the exact same way every time, folds it once, squeezing it four times. He checks his socks to make sure they're perfectly even on his calves. During the coin toss, he then faces the net and starts jumping until the coin falls down. He then immediately runs to the baseline, where he drags his foot across the entire line in a single sweeping motion before hitting each shoe with his racket. When the game begins, he starts performing repetitive hand gestures that resemble like Catholics crossing themselves. With his right hand, he touches the back and front of his shorts, then his left shoulder, then the right, then his nose, left ear, nose again, right ear, and finally he touches his right thigh. This sequence he repeats again before every serve. After each point, he goes to the towel. At each changeover, he picks up two towels, waits for the other player to cross the line, then he crosses right foot first to take his seat. He carefully folds one towel, puts it behind him without using it, then he folds the second towel and places it on his lap. He takes one sip and one sip only from his water bottle, then another sip from a second bottle. Very carefully, he returns the two bottles to the exact same position with the labels facing the same way. When the game resumes, he gives one towel to a ball boy and then crosses over to the other side to give the second towel to another ball boy. This is the end of the sequence. And this is repeated throughout the match and through every single match he has played in his career.
How incredibly exhausting.
What a weirdo.
And has someone questioned him about why he does this? Is there any reports on asking him, like, is this superstitious? Like, yeah. Why are you doing this?
In his autobiography, he wrote, look, some people call it superstition, but it's not. If it was superstition, he said, why would I keep doing the same thing over and over, whether I win or lose? He says, it's a way of placing myself in a match, ordering my surroundings to match yes. the order I seek in my head.
Yeah, and that's the fascinating thing that I was reading about this idea of harnessing you into your reality and into your surroundings. But in doing that in itself, it actually has this kind of, it's not a cult, but it is something that is supernatural. It's something that's metaphysical. And, you know, when people say, oh, it's not superstitious, but there are some out there that claim that, no, it actually is superstitious because in doing so, you are affecting the energies of the nature of reality that's around you to try and induce some type of outcome. And this is the thing, he's saying, oh, I do it both when I win and I lose, but the expectation, and he probably would never admit this, the expectation is that by doing this ritual, it's going to increase his likelihood of winning.
Of course, yeah.
That's the whole point. So you can't just say, oh, well, no. And this was studied by researchers in the article that was published in Psychology Today. In fact, they looked at how, you know, rituals can actually influence the way that someone has a well-being, like how their well-being, their emotional well-being plays a role. And there was researchers that got a group of people that weren't necessarily superstitious, that didn't have any specific beliefs, and brought them in, separated them into two groups. And in a nutshell, because obviously it was far more complex than this, but it's difficult to describe in detail these experiments. The whole nutshell was they got two groups. They told one group of people that they were tempting fate, that they were going to be involved in a horrible car accident this winter. It was likely that there was going to be a terrible car accident this winter that they were going to be involved in. So the way to dissipate that would be to knock on the table five times. Knock on wood. So,
yeah.
Right? That was on the top of the table. The second group, they told them exactly the same thing, but they told them that the way that they could vanquish it was to knock on the table or underneath the table five times going up. Now doing that, right, they then did some type of follow-up study to work out how they felt about what was the likelihood that they were going to be involved in a car accident. And perhaps not surprisingly, the group that tapped downwards, on the top of the table downwards, actually had a significantly reduced belief that they were going to likely be involved in an accident. While those that tapped upwards, like the ritual of going upwards, it somehow translated to the idea that they were more likely to be involved in some type of accident.
Is that because tapping upwards is unfamiliar? It's not something you would normally do?
I don't know. Or is it the idea of going up, that like up is increasing your chances and then tapping down is decreasing your chances?
Maybe.
No one knows. You know, there was another example though put forward by a group of people that essentially they'd lost $200 in this little lotto that they'd set up. And they got these groups of people, separated them into two groups. And one group was told to write about their grief, you know, write about how they felt about their grief and write it on a piece of paper and fold it up. The second group was told to draw about their belief, or sorry, about their grief and what had happened, and but also to sprinkle salt all over it, tear it up into multiple different pieces, and then say something five or six times, right? Just do ritual, improving ritual. They were then, at the end of the experiment, asked to describe, you know, how they felt about their loss. The people that simply wrote about the loss, put it in a letter and did nothing with it, had an increased level, not increased, but had a level of grief about losing that $200. They felt like they had been cheated, or they felt like they had no control over what had happened, and they felt a grief about it. The people that had sprinkled salt, had followed the ritual of, you know, ripping up the paper and then doing something five or six times, they had a statistically significant decrease in grief and, you know, belief in not having control over the situation. So this ritual, even though these are people that aren't necessarily superstitious, it's just a selection of people from the general populace, by introducing ritual in those two examples, it seemed to allow the person to be able to feel that they have control over their reality. And there might be something to that, right? Yes, it's a psychological element. There's something psychological, you know, playing a role here, but there also might be something metaphysical that's playing a role here as well, that we just simply don't acknowledge.
Well, there's certain aspects of society where rituals are key to everything. There's another example in that ritual book of this Reverend Matthew Hood. He was pastor at St. Lawrence Parish in Michigan. And in 2020, he was going through this old family collection of old videotapes. Mm-hmm. And on one of the videotapes was his baptism from when he was a baby. And he's watching this, you know, old, really old video, you know, probably in the attic somewhere, just reliving the memories. And he notices that when he's a baby, the deacon who performed the baptism said words that weren't quite correct. Like, instead of saying, "I baptize you," he said, "We baptize you." So he's alarmed by this. So he goes to the Archdiocese of Detroit. And this guy says, "Look, we talked to some theologians and canon lawyers, and we think it's probably valid. It's okay. Like, he's still a reverend." But then the Vatican got involved. Like, the Vatican got wind of this story and said, "No, this means that you're not actually baptized, which means that your confirmation isn't valid either, which means that your ordination as a deacon is void, which means that your ordination as a priest is void as well." So you think, okay, fine, he can fix this. He can go and get baptized. And he does. He goes and gets baptized within a week, and then he's ordained priest all over again. But there's more to the story, because this mistake meant that he hadn't been a real priest up until that moment, which meant that any sacraments he had administered during his ministry were now null and void. So the church had to contact thousands of people who had been confirmed by him and basically told they weren't, "Sorry, you're not a member of the Catholic Church," because the priest that confirmed you wasn't actually a priest. Those who were ordained found out that it wasn't legit. Those who went to confess to him said that their sins weren't absolved. People who attended Holy Communion were told that they hadn't received the Eucharist. Like, everything the guy did was considered null and void because they got this ritual wrong. The ritual was slightly wrong. And even people who got married, they were like, "Sorry, I mean, legally you're still married, but under the eyes of the church, you weren't married by a priest. So sorry, you have to come back in and do it again."
And what ramifications did this have for the people that, you know, had been essentially, you know, treated by him? Did they have a reversal of fortunes? Did people have...
No, they had to just do it all again.
See, when you look into this kind of stuff as well, it's funny how belief then starts to play a role as well, because ritual and belief are strongly interlinked with each other. So these people believed that he was a priest, right? So as a result, it caused, you know, if they were blessed and, you know, had health difficulties, you find this in so many cases of modern, you know, examinations of, certainly in voodoo death, it comes up, you know, modern healing miracles are described. Like, there's a couple of cases which I've just got in the back of my pages. I didn't even go into because I wasn't going to go there today, but there are people out there that have been miraculously healed by faith healers and by people of, you know, certain denominations. And there's also certain off branches of, you know, mainstream religions that have their kind of outliers, like their real fringe kind of groups that believe that they can do certain healing rituals. And these people are healed and they somehow have a spontaneous remission of whatever calamity that they're suffering from. But then when they find out that that particular person wasn't qualified or didn't perform the right exact ritual, there's a sudden recurrence of the illness.
Right.
And you can't, and it's not just a recurrence of the illness like, oh, well, it's clearly psychosomatic and they've got their headaches back. No, this is people that have, for example, severe high blood pressure problems will suddenly come back and it'll only be a matter of hours where they're told, oh, no, the person that you were treated by, you know, wasn't who they claimed to be, and it will cause this sudden resurgence. And even in some cases, people have severe metabolic disorders, you know, diabetes and this kind of stuff, which seemingly has miraculously been treated. And then all of a sudden, because the ritual is broken, it returns. So you can see where there's this strong link between ritual and belief. And it's almost like the ritual itself is like a physical manifestation of that belief. And from a modern perspective, you know, we laugh at this idea. We look and we, you know, refer to them as, you know, primitive cultures and, you know, prehistoric cultures and even shamanism. And it's mocked and it's laughed at because this belief that you've got some type of ability to remotely affect someone else, whether to heal them or to hurt them, is completely absurd. But there are a whole heap of experiences and cases that come from the Victorian era where it was readily believed that you could somehow perform ritual or you could perform, you know, a practice in some way to remotely hurt someone or bring about their death or destruction. You know, we talk about it here. We've got the, you know, the Australian Aboriginal culture. There's a really great example of, I think it was John B. Cleland, who was a professor of pathology at the University of Adelaide. And he has done a lot of research into the natives of the Australian bush and how they respond to having the bone pointed at them. And a great example was highlighted by Dr. Cleland in 1928, where he had met this robust tribesman in Central Australia. And this guy was just, he was a big built guy. There was just nothing that could bring him down until one day he was hit with a spear. And at first he pulls the spear out and he's just like, oh, it's a spear, I'm fine. He finds out it's an enchanted spear and he drops dead within 24 hours or within a day or so, just a little bit more.
Yeah, there was a case in the ritual book I was reading by Maxwell Maltz. He was this cosmetic surgeon in New York in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And he had this patient, his name was Mr. Russell, he's a Caribbean guy. And he obviously believed in voodoo. And when he told his girlfriend he had spent all his savings on cosmetic surgery for his lower lip, which is why he was seeing this cosmetic surgeon, he wanted his lip fixed up, she flipped out. Like, his girlfriend went berserk and put a voodoo curse on him. Now, at first, this guy didn't pay much attention to his crazy girlfriend's voodoo curse, but the next day, he discovers a small lump on the inside of his lip and he becomes convinced this is the curse from his girlfriend. It's like called an African bug and it's slowly going to consume his soul. It's going to turn him into a wafer. So by the time he goes back to this cosmetic surgeon, he goes back to this doctor, this surgeon said it's like he had completely changed in a period of a week or two. This guy was big, like he was 6'4", very big and muscular, like an athletic physique. And he sits down in this guy's office and it looked like, this is what the surgeon said, it looked like he had aged 20 years. Like, wow. His hands were shaking, his eyes and cheeks were sunken. He had lost 30 pounds. He'd lost 30 pounds in a couple of weeks. And they call this like, yeah, this is supposed to be some kind of slow voodoo death. But the surgeon didn't believe in any of it. He thought it was nonsense. And what he basically did was removed this lump with a scalpel and showed it to the African guy and was like, or the Jamaican guy, and was like, look, it's just a scar. It's gone. What you've got nothing to worry about. Now, this guy just took it as in, oh, doctor, you've removed the curse. Amazing. I feel so much better. The curse is gone. And he immediately got better. And again, one of the reasons why I kind of backed out of this book is that the whole point is like, oh, this is all psychosomatic. Like, it's just psychological. And yes, of course it is psychological. But we've covered so many cases in the past that demonstrate that, you know, there's instances where it can't be purely psychological. I mean,
there's other factors that are playing a role here.
Yeah, there's something else going on. And this was never entertained in any of these examples.
It's disappointing because there are so many, as you point out, so many examples of this occurring. And it's not just within, you know, ancient cultures, cultures that are considered to be primitive, tribal cultures. It happens in modern times. There is a strong superstition amongst even the most hardened of supernatural skeptics, where a curse can sometimes play a role. It can play a role in them having immense fear. Of course, when I was describing what David Clark looked into, he was looking at the idea of like a fear factor, a death by fear, which is induced by seeing ghosts. And this is why there were juries that looked into this kind of stuff. And there's a whole heap of stories in here. They're only very short, but they're describing cases of where juries have been asked to look into, you know, like a coroner in a way, as to the surrounding details of someone's death. And in many of these cases in Victorian eras, the conclusion was come to that it was death from fear, death from a supernatural being. And a lot of the times a magistrate or someone in power would step in and adjust it.
Well, say, which one is it? Is it death from fear or death from a supernatural being?
Well, the fear of the supernatural being. So the supernatural being induces the fear, which then results in the death. So, you know, from a modern perspective, we would go, that's absolutely absurd. Like there's no way that that could happen, but there's plenty of these cases. I mean, there was one example of Elizabeth Annie Bishop. She was 17 years old. She was a servant girl. And the jury had all this inquest, had heard evidence that before her death, she had repeatedly reported seeing the ghost of her master's brother who had been lost in a shipping accident. Now, these experiences frightened her so much that her employers could not induce her to leave her room. She seemingly was overwhelmed by this. And you could go, well, there's no such thing as ghosts. You're being ridiculous. But she's like, no, I saw them. I saw them. And according to the evidence that was heard at the inquest, shortly before her death, she said that she had seen the ghost of her cousin who had been dead for 2 years. So the verdict of the case was described as being a fainting fit brought about by excessive fear. This was 1894. It was readily believed that the supernatural experiences could induce enough fear to bring about someone's death. Now, this is kind of backwards. Like, it seems like it's a backwards idea, but there are other examples of where we start crossing into the possibility that ritual and belief can absolutely influence a person. And I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's like a metaphysical field. Maybe it damages your auric field or something like that, but it results in some type of supernatural injury that can then ultimately result in your death. It leaves you vulnerable. It leaves you open. There was an example of Anna Hanks. Now, Anna Hanks lived in Greenwich. And after her death, which was also described as being, you know, a mysterious death, the post-mortem examination showed that she clearly died from fright, but there was no explanation. Her brother appeared at the inquest, described what had happened just before she died. Apparently, she was enveloped in a cloud of thick white smoke that appeared in her bedroom. The smoke followed her around the room. It then encompassed her head where sparks came flying out of it. Once the smoke disappeared, she fell to the floor and passed away. So I was like, okay, I'm kind of intrigued by this. Is there a possibility that, you know, was she attacked by some type of supernatural being? Is this what happened? And there are other reports out there.
The sparks are a dead giveaway.
That's kind of a dead giveaway, right? But it's like, is this a voodoo death? Are there other factors that are playing a role here? You know, was she somehow set up, you know, by another being, well, another person?
A black sorcerer.
And this is where we then cross into the more unusual aspects of ritual. And this is where we cross into dark magic, you know, witchcraft, occult practices. There are so many stories out there of people utilizing this stuff for their own gain, for their own wealth. And let's go into some of these cases. You know, one of the most extreme examples that I was reading about, and I thought this was kind of, it's strange because it actually ties in with what John Keel looked into with the TNT area around the Mothman sightings. Of course, with the Mothman sightings, where Mothman first, you know, was originally seen was at this TNT depot. It was a TNT production site during the Second World War, which had been taken over later on in the 60s and turned into a reserve. But back in the Second World War, they manufactured a huge amount of TNT. I think at peak production capacity, it was described that it was able to produce like 500,000 pounds of TNT per day, right? So this is an interesting site because it became a military site where there's rumors surrounding this that prior to this site actually being a manufacturing site for TNT, it actually had a great amount of burial mounds that were on this site. And at this site, there must have been some type of American Indian or Native American practices, maybe perhaps shamanic practices that were taking place at this particular site. And I was reading through the blog of Gene Akemeyer, and he has a very intriguing, I guess, theory about what went on with this site. So with this particular site, because what they wanted to do was hide the production of TNT from anything that may have been flying over. Obviously, you know, it didn't get to that point, but it's wartime. So they built these little igloo kind of huts. There was like 100 or so igloo huts that were built on this site. And they were covered over with dirt so that they would just look like normal land. But this is where they could store all this huge amounts of TNT. By the time the Mothman sightings happened, it was being used as part of the place was a reserve. Part of it was being used as a store. But apparently what else had happened was prior to the site being built, because it had these burial mounds upon it, there must have been some type of shamanic practice that may have taken place at this site. This is before everything had happened. Now, I want to link you to this image, and Ben, I'll send you this image as well so you can take a look.
Yeah.
But this here, this apparently is a shaman, right? This is a Native American shaman. And there's a certain type of practice because apparently in the Great Mound in Hopewell in Ohio.
Why has he got such a funny hat?
It's not a hat, right? It's this copper headdress. And this copper headdress, it's obviously goes over the head and then it comes down at the sides. And inside this mound, they also found this tube that was lying next to him. And this tube was actually a piece of femur. And the femur had this delicate but intricate inscription and drawing in it, which also showed the headdress in a way. Now, it's believed that this headdress was utilized by this shaman in bringing forth entities, right? It was sometimes referred to as deer ears. This is what researchers have described this kind of helmet as being. And with this bone tube could be utilized to control the entities from another reality, other entities coming through. Now, if you look very closely at this image here, Ben, this is the second image that I'll put in the show notes. This was what the middle image is, what was inscribed in the bone. And this looks like a shaman wearing this particular helmet or this particular headdress with the sides, the copper sides coming down at the side. Look what it looks very similar to the first sightings of.
It's Mothman.
It's Mothman. It's almost identical to what people saw Mothman at that particular site.
Oh, now, it's bizarre.
There's a lot of stories out there, right? So this has come from people before. See, John Keel even had suggested that this was ultra-terrestrials, you know, kind of indicating that there was a dimensional portal here of some kind. Other people over the years have come forward and said, look, all throughout my childhood, before this site was built and after this site was built and it had been returned, there have been sightings of people in black robes heading into this particular location to do something. Now, no one knows exactly what was going on, but the presence of a black robe indicates that there's some type of ritual taking place.
As soon as you see black robe, you know what's going on.
So there's speculation that perhaps what had happened was not only, maybe this site was the site previously of some type of traditional shamanic summoning of entities of some kind. And if you do it correctly, if you follow a certain ritual that's been honed over many, 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 many generations, it works properly, right? But then you've got a group of people that are going there for nefarious purposes, that are going there for wealth and power and control. They start doing something and they have no idea of what they're doing. They're doing the ritual, but they're doing it in a sloppy fashion in the late 1960s. This is what unleashed Mothman at this site and upon that town.
That's awesome.
It's awesome. I'll link to his blog in the show notes so you can actually read it for yourself. He goes into great detail describing this. And look, he even suggests, he's like, is it possible that there were unseen forces that were beckoned by someone in that TNT area? And we have to realize that around that time, there was Project MK Often. Now, MK Often was, you know, essentially, it was tested. It was conducted by the Department of Defense. It was a covert program. It's been acknowledged, or at least it's been, there's enough information out there to demonstrate that, yes, MK Often was an actual program. And apparently this particular program, it was used for toxicological testing on certain drugs on animals and humans. But apparently, according to author Gordon Thomas, he published a book in 2007 called Secrets and Lies, the CIA's Operation Often. This was initiated by Sidney Gottlieb. And then we know what Gottlieb was doing. But a lot of it was to explore the world of black magic and harness the forces of darkness and for utilization against foreign powers. So, and apparently Gottlieb got a whole, and obviously other CIA employees, they got a whole group of fortune tellers, palm readers, clairvoyants, astrologers, mediums, psychics, people specializing in demonology, witches and warlocks, Satanists, and a whole range of satanic practice, you know, people, practitioners involved in this program. And possibly did they conduct testing at this site?
Are you suggesting that a CIA occult program launched Mothman on West Virginia?
Well, I'm not suggesting that, but I'm putting together the work of a multitude of people that are hinting towards, yes, that's exactly what happened.
It opened up a portal and Mothman came through and caused havoc.
Yeah. And you can go, well, that's absurd. Like, that's absolutely absurd. You know, there's no way that that would happen. Well, it just so happens there are many stories out there where it's happened over and over and over again. And
well, the Mothman's come through.
Not Mothman, but there have been groups of people that have attempted to harness interdimensional beings for their own nefarious purposes. And I could see why, you know, weaponizing some type of demonic creature would be great to have against your adversaries, whether you're a government trying to do it or if you're a group of individuals, you know, trying to do it. And this is where we come to the story of Julia, which was reported to Nick Redfern back in 2004. So Nick Redfern states that he was on this trek around Puerto Rico for a television show when he came across a woman who lived in Ponce, and he just calls her Julia because it's a very controversial story that he says he has on his records. And Julia came to him and claimed to know a great deal about a secret society that was doing some very unusual things. And she starts talking about her ex-husband, and she claimed that her ex-husband was a member of this group. And it just so happened that he was also a very powerful figure on the island, specifically in the real estate business. And he had been invited into this group in 1999, which is around a year before Julia and he married. Now, as a result of his connections with this group, it ultimately led to her divorcing him. She got the hell out. But the details of this secret life, you know, took a while to come out. And she finally, you know, contacted Nick Redfern and described exactly what happened. Julia claimed that her husband had told her that it was due to a certain supernatural pact between the group and a group of paranormal denizens of the realms beyond our own, that is why he had so much prestige, power, and money. And it was because this group was dealing with malignant supernatural beings from other dimensions. And apparently this practice, this ritual, revolved around blood. There was blood. And I'm like, oh my, like, this is wild, right? It's like satanic cults and, you know, they utilize that. This sounds absurd, but it may not necessarily be so. Like, we have to take this with a grain of salt. But Nick, obviously intrigued by this woman setting up this story, dug deeper. He wanted to know more and more about this, you know, what was going on. So Julia's husband had been present at this particular ritual that was held in this spacious home of a Puerto Rican drug baron. And apparently his success was down to being a member of this secret society and making a pact with some type of interdimensional denizen. And now Julia says to Nick, there's no way that I can prove any of this because it's just so outrageous and so crazy. But I promise you that there is this group, these people, and they're supplied with blood. So they don't necessarily go out and attack anyone or take people. They've got a doctor who's on the take, and this doctor will go and get blood from donors. And these donors are paid extremely well for their donation and for their silence. And so apparently this particular ritual that took place that was reported by Julia was that it was two women and one man. They had their blood removed, but when their blood was extracted, they were placed on an ornate large altar. So it was kind of like had this... It was like a sacrifice, but it wasn't because they were just simply having their blood taken. But it's all part of the ritual.
Yeah, it's
right?
The symbolism.
It's the
ritual.
Symbolism, exactly. That's what was going on. And it all had this very much ritualistic-driven process that was taking place. Now, the blood was ultimately used to conjure up some type of entity. So the blood was removed. It was placed in the center of the room. You know, the ritual was performed. Of course, they were all dressed in cloaks, and Nick says no less. And they all focused their minds on having this entity appear. And according to Julia, What took place is that after a amount of focused, intense energy was put into whatever this process was, the lights in the house, and it seems almost cliche, doesn't it? But the lights in the house would flicker, the room would fill with a nauseating odor of sulfur, and in seconds, the air would start to shimmer. It was like a heat haze on the road on a hot summer's day. And slowly, before their eyes, a creature would slowly come into being, and it would be staring at the group in this malevolence, and it was hunched over. Now, apparently, even though this group had been doing this for a long time, that never actually manifested physically.
Oh, this is the first time.
This is the first time that they've manifested one of these beings.
They're like, what do we do now? Oh, crap.
So the group was shocked to their collective core, according to Nick, at what they were seeing. But it was exactly what the group was counting on. But seeing the monster up close and personal was obviously something else entirely. Now, much like there's the theory that the CIA unleashed the Mothman upon the world, well, where are we? We're in Puerto Rico.
And I know what it is.
The right time where what they saw was a chupacabra that was semi-transparent. It was far more spectral than it was physical. That was, of course, until the monster placed its clawed paws into a large bowl that contained substantial amounts of the blood that had been poured into it. Within seconds of the creature doing so, its transparency was no more, and it was suddenly completely physical. So it needed the blood, the physical blood, to allow this thing to manifest correctly in our reality. Now, once apparently the creature was satiated and fed, it vanished in a bright blue flash.
Well, I thought they had control of it. I thought they summoned it to do their bidding.
Exactly. They did it. But somehow, obviously, because these rituals had been taking place, this is maybe the ritual in itself was like they needed to believe. So by granting them their wishes, it kind of built everything up until finally this thing could manifest.
I remember doing a segment on this, but it was to do with Mexican cartel drug runners.
Yes.
They were doing some kind of variation of Santa Muerte where they were trying to summon entities. But the whole purpose behind it was so that dark entities would protect them from the DEA.
That's right.
And they believed that they wouldn't be arrested or they'd be at least protected in some way from being caught.
Well, and this is where you start crossing into, some of the stories surrounding the chupacabra and this entity, because the entity in this story, it needed to consume that blood to appear physical, right? Well, we know what the chupacabra does. It's a blood sucker. It's a vampiric being. Well, that's because for it to be able to remain in our physical reality, it still needs to consume blood. And that's why it's this entity that's been unleashed upon Puerto Rico that people are seeing.
Chupacabra, case closed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly what to, believe at that, but I think it's wild because you've got the story of these other beings, like other cryptozoological beings that you hear, but they're not manifesting. They're not necessarily flesh and blood until they're interacting with human beings.
It's the same thing with Bigfoot, except he has to eat an entire jar of peanut butter to stay physical.
It has to be a blessed jar of peanut butter. You got to sprinkle some chocolate on the top. But then, finally, with the ritual, he'll come through. There was actually another story that I was reading where I couldn't find any greater detail about it. But there was the appearance in, I think it was Pennsylvania, in the 70s. I don't know if it was the 73 flap where there was the UFOs connected to Bigfoot. But there were reports of just small animals, small livestock, chickens and, very, very small animals that were being found drained completely of their blood. And what had happened was is that people had claimed that when they confronted one of the entities or one of these things that was lurking around their property, it was a Bigfoot that was consuming the blood of the chicken.
What? How?
I know. And I'm like, this is, wild. And I couldn't find any more details about it. But I thought it ties in kind of perfectly with that story we just heard. It was like it needed something. Blood. What's the importance of blood? You know that great story.
Life force, energy.
It's life force, exactly. It's this metaphysical energy which is somehow, made physical in the blood and it's consumed by these beings. And for them to be able to remain in our reality, they need to consume that somehow. And in fact, after you kind of, looked into Steiner, Rudolf Steiner, I started looking into some of his stuff as well. And Steiner is fascinating because, he was very much convinced of the idea of essentially these parasites that were consuming these non-physical but very much real parasites that were consuming the anxiety and fear are the two terms he used. These entities purposely induced anxiety and fear in people so that they could exist. And apparently if you removed anxiety and fear that these things would starve and they would move on to other people, but he was quite convinced of the reality of these things. And that's why we have, you know, so many problems with anxiety and fear and this kind of stuff in the world, because it's a metaphysical non-human intelligence that's doing it. And somehow occasionally through the use of ritual and practice, it appears in our reality. So it sounds absurd, right? But if you go back, you know, through history, there's a whole range of people in different traditions, different cultures that have described something very, very similar. So let's go to Iceland in the 17th century. And I want to bring you to the concept of necropants.
Necropants.
Necropants. So this is quite unusual. So during the
17th... Pants of the dead?
Yes, but you have to wear them. So in the 17th century in Iceland, things weren't great. You know, apparently the society was very suppressed. Apart from the ultra, ultra wealthy, everyone was living in stone huts. You know, there'd been the Reformation, I think, with Christianity. So the traditional beliefs and that kind of stuff had all been wiped out. People were being persecuted. It was quite horrible and people were starving. You know, people weren't able to get food. But with those ancient folkloric traditions and practices, there was this idea. There was two main ones that come up, and I'll link to it from Atlas Obscura in the show notes so you can see some of the, you know, I guess the recreations of these things. It's quite wild. But you had the Tilbury. Now, the Tilbury was this two-headed snake thing that could be used to steal goat's milk. And the way that you created this thing, you actually summoned it by stealing a rib from a corpse that was only recently interred. You wrapped the bone with grey wool, which was also stolen, preferably from the sheep of the widow. The totem would then be kept between a woman's breasts, during which time she must spit out her communion bread or wafer.
What the hell?
For 3 Sundays and then feed it to the fetish, which would slowly grow and become alive until it was suckling the inside of her thigh, where it left a mark like a wart. Once this gross creature reached maturity, it would slink off to a neighbor's land, suckle the goat's milk, draining them completely, and then would roll back to its creator's home to expel the stolen milk to be made into butter. So tradition, you see this physical ritual that has to take place. And this is a very, very old ritualistic practice that had come forth to allow these people to live, like, because they were so poor and they had food problems, and this is what was done. The other one was a little bit more about attaining wealth. And that's what a lot of these practices, really from a modern perspective, if you talk about modern satanic cults, yeah, I mean, people will say it's about contacting demons and communing with them. But the ultimate purpose really is that it's about, as I said before, it's about power and fortune. This is what people are doing it for. So we come to the story of the nabrok, or the necropants. So these leggings were the main component of a ritual that was said to bring the caster unlimited wealth.
But are they made out of human skin or something gross?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. According to the ritual, to create a pair of these necropants, the sorcerer must first make a pact with a friend. So Ben, this would be you and me, right? So we've got to make a pact that one of us is going to become necropants, right? Once that friend dies of natural causes, right?
Natural causes.
The sorcerer has permission to skin them from the waist down.
Right.
Once the friend is dead, the greedy magician must then wait until the friend has been buried, dig up the body, and then skin the lower half of the corpse without creating any holes or tears, thus creating a pair of necropants.
Yeah, that'll ruin the pants if you create a hole.
That's right. So then you put on these pants, apparently, against your bare skin, and then the ritual requires you to steal a coin from the destitute's widow and then place the coin in the empty scrotum of the pants, along with a magical Icelandic symbol written on a scrap of parchment, and then that's it. Soon the pants become indistinguishable from the wearer's body and you're wandering around with these pants, right? And then your balls cough up cash. That's why you put the coin in. Because the scrotum will continuously and miraculously continue to fill with coins for the rest of time.
Is it every time you cough, it just goes ching and all these coins come out?
Yes, that's exactly what happens. So you could see this, obviously, you know, surely no one is doing this. There is some macabre recreations of these necropants that have been placed into museums. But yes, the likelihood of this actually happening, but maybe there were people. Maybe the fact that this is out there, but maybe there were people that believed that by following these certain types of rituals, that you could use it to attain wealth or, you know, attain something else. You know, also, actually, the pagan beliefs of the spirits of departed friends and relatives were quite common in Iceland around the time. And I think for most cultures around the time, we're talking the 17th century. But, you know, raising the body of a dead person really opens up a can of worms. You know, it's a very, very dangerous thing to do because once you start, you know, bringing people back from the dead, are you actually bringing that person back? And there were rituals at the time where you could perform, you know, a ritual of shouting out poetry or invocation by wandering around a graveyard where you could bring a person back to life. And you'd also have to spit on the grave. So again, it's got this, you know, liquid, this substance coming from the living human to be able to bring it back. But in this particular ritual that was practiced in Iceland around the 17th century, you could summon up a dead person and then utilize them to sick onto your enemies. So what you would do is...
It's a zombie.
It is a zombie. It's exactly... It's a zombie ritual that was practiced in Iceland in the 17th century. And there's a few tricks to it, though. When you would go into the cemetery and you would bring up this particular body, you'd have to make sure it was someone that was a consumer of a large amount of soy. It'd have to be someone that was very weak because once the person was revived, they would be 9 times stronger than what they were in life. So it was always said, you know, choose someone who, you know, wasn't a strong fisherman or a farmer. It'd have to be a teenager or someone who wasn't very strong. Once they get up, you then have to fight them. So you got to fight him and get into this punch up. As you're fighting them, you have to lick up all the liquid that streams out of the nose and mouth. And that's how you tame them. Once you've done that, you can tell it to do whatever you want to do. And that's when you could sick it onto another person. You know, and this was...
How are you supposed to lick up all this horrible fluid while you're fighting them?
I don't know. Yeah, but like how you're licking the face of someone else as you're doing it. But this thing was like the atomic bombs of rituals. Because once you sicked this zombie, this spit zombie on someone else, it wouldn't just affect them. It would also follow through the next 7 generations. So it had this long-term consequence for, you know, people if you did this. And of course, there was...
So the victim's family suffers as well.
Yeah, and then...
It's like the idea of the zombie bite spreading.
That's right.
Right.
And then it would become, you know, this idea that it could ricochet onto other people and then it would then transform into, rather than it being a physical entity, it would become a non-physical entity and then it would become bad luck. And again, it's all superstition and belief. But it demonstrates the history of this kind of stuff being out there. So let's head a little bit into the future. It's in the past for us. But let's head to 1932, where there was a London theatre actor by the name of Ian Davidson. And Ian Davidson is a fascinating character in that he'd kind of grown tired of the limelight. And apparently his job was quite stressful and he'd grown tired of all of it. And he decided that he wanted to head out into the secluded rural countryside because the constant pressure of theatre life had overwhelmed him. He thought going into nature would be a great idea. So he did, right? He goes out to the rolling green countryside of Kent at the time to retire. He looks for this house and he just happens to find this rundown farm. It was known as Brandon Farm and it was a fixer-upper. It was a 400-year-old house. It was weed-choked. It was a feral mess. It was overgrown with everything that was on the outside of the house, rotting floorboards, weathered walls, sagging roof. Not a great thing to do, but apparently Davidson was quite happy to restore this property and bring it back to its previous glory. But within moments, within days of being in this site, odd things started to happen around the home. So you'd hear incessant rapping. There would be tapping on the bedroom walls. At night, the windows would rattle. He would obviously search the house trying to find any explanation for it, and he wouldn't, until things started to graduate. And this kind of has the feel for, remember how I did the episode on the Abramalian meltdown? And that was where Crowley had gone into his house and he had tried to perform this practice, this deeply ritualistic practice. I was almost going to say spiritual, but it wasn't spiritual because it had a demonic kind of feel to it. We also know the other rituals that Crowley has practiced out in the desert in the, the hope of summoning entities. But within the Abramalian meltdown, ultimately he had set off this Chernobyl in the home because he didn't finish the practice. He opened the portal by performing this ritual to bring something through, but he never closed it again because he gave up on the ritual. It seems like that's exactly what happened to Davidson, because Davidson started experiencing things like having nightmares. There was one particular room which he referred to as the box room, and this is because that's where they stored, you know, items and boxes in there. But this particular room would result in guests complaining that they would wake up being strangled. There was this sinister paranormal energy that was in this room, and it would go through extreme temperature fluctuations. It would be freezing cold to scorching hot within moments, and it just became this, you know, horrible sight. But then the apparitions started to appear, and it's like spending more time in here and not being scared away. It was somehow powering these things. And this is what, while no particular ritual was being performed, it was like the phenomenon or whatever it was, whatever was there, needed the human interference, needed the human presence to be able to manifest in our world. And he had things like, there was this woman that would appear and she looked forlorn. She was in a gray dress, and she was just, whenever she was seen, there would be a feeling of wretchedness and extreme depression and despondency in the air, which would transfer into people that would be visiting or Davidson himself, and they would be overcome with this irrational sadness. Then there was this ugly, stocky little man who would march about the house. He was preoccupied. He was irritated, not particularly frightening or malevolent, but this is a lot of activity to happen in a house, you know, only very soon, you know, going into this place. Like, what is occurring here? But then ultimately, Davidson described this foul-looking man that appeared one day, and he appeared just before this hearth or this fireplace. And he was wearing a surreal costume of bright green, brown, and red. He had this jagged kind of smile about him, but his appearance was always heralded by this phantom black cat. Now, all these kind of cliche things, like when you think about satanic rituals or the occult, there's all these cliches that kind of pop up, but there might be a reason for that because they're required in the ritual. So after this happens, because he's in the theater company and he's got connections, he happens to get in contact with a psychic and paranormal investigator by the name of Ronald Colbeck. And Colbeck, you know, came to this particular location, to this farm. He checked out the box room. He said it was just filled with a crushing sense. You know, it was oozing this raw fear in the space. It was just truly horrible. He would be attacked by unseen hands in the night that would grab at his throat. An entity would pull at his hair. It just got worse and worse and worse until finally, you know, Colbeck's like, you've got a problem here. And the problem is that I've worked out exactly who this person is. The grinning man that you're seeing, his name is George Tarver. He was actually an occultist from the 16th century who was running a coven of witches in this site. So what had happened was, is that they had conducted these horrible, horrible rituals where they'd killed a cat, that forlorn woman, that he'd killed his wife because his wife had gotten unhappy about how bad this had happened. So he'd murdered her. He'd strangled her, hence the strangulation that was happening. And ultimately, the way that, you know, because Davidson had learned about this, he actually continued his renovation work. And when this entity appeared, he started shouting at it and telling it off. And that seemingly was enough to dissipate it, and it disappeared. He then saw the woman and this other man that was hanging around. It was almost like they were happy because they were able to be released from this site. They were able to go. And I thought, okay, I'm intrigued by that, because what is it about, you know, the ritual trapping entities in a certain site as well? Is it that you open a portal and entities come through and they can't go back again? Is that what's occurred? Or because they were doing some type of black magic here that was being conducted by Tava, is it that when he killed his wife, that his wife couldn't cross over for some reason? And why did they reappear? Well, I got a possible answer from a book called Dead Zones. Now, this was edited by Sharon Jarvis, but it's got a whole collection of stories, which I might go into, you know, on a future episode. But it's got a collection of essays and stories of people that have experienced, you know, very, very strange things.
Is this one of your 33-cent readers from the 1960s?
Yeah, this is one of my 33-cent readers. And this is fascinating because it relates to Southmoreland Park, which is located at 47th and Oak Street in Kansas City in Missouri. It's just across the street from the William Rockhill Nelson Gallery, which is, you know, an art gallery and institute. But back in 1970, Maurice Schwelm, who was a paranormal researcher, Maurice had a very, very strange experience. So he walks into this location. He'd been conducting paranormal investigations around this area for a while. He'd been told that, because obviously people had contacted him and told him that they'd seen weird things in this park, that there was a university complex or an apartment complex that was nearby. It's the 1970s. There's a whole heap of hippies still around. And he walks into this park one day, and when he walks into the park, he sees this, like, everything changes before him. It's like he has this psychic kind of vision take place, and it's like he's rooted to the spot, and there's this massive flowing river before him, and this river is flowing, and there's a scene, and he sees people kind of paying tribute to the river and respecting it, and there's a Native American that does so, and then there's, you know, what appears to be a European later on. And he's suddenly, shaken out of the scene by Dee Dee. And Dee Dee just happens to be a sensitive who travels around with him as they do these investigations. So Maurice shakes himself out of it. And Dee Dee looks at him. She's like, oh, my God, I just saw you in this triangle. He's like, what triangle? What are you describing? And she's like, there's a triangle. It's a right angle triangle. You're at the very bottom of it, but I can see it. And you're going to be involved in it for the next 20 years. And he says, "Oh, that's absurd, right? You know, that's just really crazy." So the moral of this particular story, which is like the whole conclusion comes to him, is that he goes through these weird experiences investigating, you know, different things at this location. And it turns out that there's a triangle of phenomenon that's taking place. Mm. But that triangle of phenomenon is somehow connected to this waterway that he saw in the vision, right? And the waterway in the vision was actually there. Back in pioneer times, there was this waterway, but because the park had been put in or some type of, you know, construction had taken place, the creek or this waterway was piped and placed underground. So he had no knowledge of that. And yet somehow that validated for him that he'd seen something, right? That he had actually seen something genuine, something real. But that's not why I'm mentioning this story, right? That's just, you know, setting the scene for what happened with Maurice. The reason why Maurice went to this particular accommodation is because there were a bunch of students that needed his and Dee Dee's help because they'd performed a ritual and had unleashed something terrifying.
Uh-oh.
So he goes in, right? He goes up and he meets this guy, and he just for the sake of the story, he just calls them, you know, John and Jane Doe. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's really cliche because it's like, hey, man, oh, yeah, come here. We're just doing, you know, smoking some hash. It's really good. You want to come in? And so he goes into this place and he's like, well, what's your problem? Like, what's the issue? And he's like, oh, we've been just tripping on acid and I don't know how real it is, but we've got a problem. And he says, well, what? And without going through too much detail, ultimately, they described that it just started with John and Jane Doe taking acid and they were performing occult rituals. Now, when they were taking acid and performing occult rituals in this apartment, or this apartment complex, you know, in student accommodation, they started to see things. Like they started to see this weird red form entity that would appear, this red kind of humanoid form that would show up. And he started communicating with them. He started giving them information and it was getting kind of wild. But people were taking, more and more people in the dorm were hearing about this. So they were coming down and taking drugs. And so more and more people were coming in. And as doing so, this entity was getting stronger and stronger. And the reason why they contacted Maurice is because people started to see it during the day when they weren't taking drugs. So they've been taking, I think it was like 20 sessions or something that large groups of people from all across this floor had.
What drugs were they taking? Just marijuana?
LSD. No, it was LSD. They were tripping on LSD. They were taking marijuana as well, but they were tripping on LSD when they were performing these rituals. And other people that weren't under the influence of drugs that were living on this floor were now starting to see this entity hanging around. And this entity did a couple of things. They loved this entity because the entity would do things like help them score more drugs. So it would go out. It apparently would go out and influence drug dealers to come to them so that they could get their drugs at a cheaper price or, you know, something like that. And the other one was it would go to the parents and convince the parents to hand over cash to the kids. And so this was perfect. And so Maurice is saying, well, what am I doing here? What do you want from me? And they're like, we want the entity. We actually want to deal with it more. We want to keep it here. He's like, I can't help with that. There is no way. I am not going to do anything to assist you in keeping this entity here.
Wow.
But Dee Dee was like, look, I can at least, you know, try and go into a trance and I can see what's going on, right? And they're like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, do that. You know, we want to talk to it. So they do. she goes into this trance and they find out that this entity that they'd brought through, this entity that was performing, it was demonic. It was bad. It was a bad entity, but they wanted to find out its name because as part of the ritual, if they found out its name, they thought they could control it.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's a very bad thing. This entity had no interest whatsoever in giving over its name, and it didn't. But what they found out is that these idiots, in tripping on acid and performing some arcane ritual that they have no purpose in doing so, you know, no understanding of what they were doing, yes, they'd brought this entity through, it had been trapped here. They hadn't allowed it to be able to get back. So this is why the entity was appearing when people were not on drugs. It stuck here as a result. And obviously, Maurice didn't go into any greater detail in this story. He didn't describe what happened to them afterwards. But essentially, that unleashed this being through this irresponsible use of ritual to physically manifest it in our reality.
And what, it's still there to this day, well, helping people score drugs?
Yeah, well, as apparently, according to the story, I mean, this is a story, as I said, 1970s. But, you know, it's like, this is the dangers of this kind of stuff. And because they were directly engaging with it, it's like, you don't want this thing hanging around. It's really irresponsible. It's really foolish, but it's a great example of, you know, many of these stories I've told today. We can dismiss ritual. We can say how absurd it is. There's so many examples though of people that have done this, whether deliberately or, you know, throughout just without using due care, have actually manifested physical entities from other realities in our world, and it affects other people.
This ties in perfectly with what I've got coming up in Plus. This is
excellent.
Precisely what's going on with this conspiracy of Paul McCartney being replaced by a double because it's all a ritual involving Aleister Crowley.
Yeah. And this is what it is. There's a great deal of power that's connected to ritual, but it's why it is arcane knowledge. It's why it is hidden. And, you know, when people get a hold of it, unless they have been practicing for a long time and have a great deal of understanding with it, you can't control. And even then, you can't control it. And there's always a price to pay as well. There's always ultimately a price that you have to pay with this. So look, I'll link to all of that in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org so you can check it out for yourself. There's one final story that I want to mention for you that's kind of, it could be an urban legend. It's certainly out there. It's a little bit wild. But I want to mention it anyway because it does fit in with these stories that I've been describing today. It also fits in with what we know about, you know, rumors of the Third Reich, Himmler engaging in occult practices or being obsessed with it. You know, this relates to the Selnoy Rath House. And this was a large kind of Gothic architecture style home. Essentially, it translates to New Town Hall. But what this was a very large brick structure that was built 20 miles northeast of Hanover. Hanover was a relatively small town. It only had about 40,000 people in it. But this large brick structure was ultimately occupied by British forces. There was German soldiers there at one point. And when the town surrendered on the 12th of April in 1945, this particular house was occupied by British troops. And the British troops handed it over to the Americans. And this story came out of it about what the Americans experienced and what they saw. So according to some of the legends that are out there, and I'll link to the full story in the show notes so you can see all the actual intimate details of it, but I'm just going to kind of gloss over it and give you a nutshell version. When the British went in, apparently there was something odd about this place because they found that all of the lower floors, so there was five upper levels, and then apparently there was five levels that were below this particular location. And the architecture was strange. There was also weird sigils that were carved into some of the bricks. And later on, there was, you know, allegations of there being pentagrams or pentagram-looking things that were in there. It already has this idea of it being a ritualistic location because the Gothic architecture directly related to some type of physical, you know, ritual. It somehow enhanced the rituals that were conducted at this site. And when the British handed it over to the Americans, it was the bottom five floors were filled with water. Like, it was filled with water. It was covered over by concrete. It was done hastily because they saw banisters, like stair banisters, sticking up out of the concrete. So that's how, they hadn't even removed it. They just poured concrete over the top. So what could possibly be down there? Now, at the moment, it doesn't have any connotation of it being occult or supernatural, because it's just simply, well, the Nazis were stealing treasures. They were stealing objects to art, you know. That kind of stuff must be down there. So they smashed their way through. And the story goes that the American forces sent three divers down into this lower levels. And they went through a tethered line. And about 30 minutes after being underwater, only one man resurfaced. The other two men had disappeared. And this guy was traumatized. He was completely traumatized. He'd gone through what he claims to be this harrowing experience while underwater. He claimed that as soon as they went under, they saw more of these sigils etched into the walls. There was pentagrams and pagan occult symbols that were on the floors. And as they swam down to the third floor, they came across a mass of mutilated bodies.
Ugh.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh, this is, you know, horrible. And apparently he saw vivisected abdomens, missing limbs.
What?
There were, you know, animal appendages lying around as well. It's just, it's a horrible, horrible scene. We know that the Nazis were performing horrible mutilations. So maybe this site was some type of medical testing site or something akin to what Dr. Mengele would be doing. But perhaps not, because according to other sources and other people that have made claims that they've been in this particular site. And in fact, I've got it here. It came from a man. I've got this from Richard White. Richard White published a report from 2021 where he claims that an anonymous soldier had come forward, or the son of a soldier had come forward, and said that no, what was actually occurring here is that the Nazis were utilizing this as some type of ritual site to invoke interdimensional powers so that they could obviously overwhelm the Allies. And what they had done is that they were performing a practice of trying to reanimate dead soldiers. And in doing so, now, the fact that it's described as vivisections and, you know, flesh and blood, and, you know, you hear about with the satanic rituals being in satanic panic, being involved in cattle mutilations, it has all the same kind of concoctions that are connected with these ideas. That there's like a physical substance, a physical human substance that has to be used to bring about these things. Now, this soldier claims that not only were they bringing in concentration camp victims, unfortunately, from the Bergen-Belsen camp that wasn't too far away, they were doing this to reanimate soldiers, and they did. Apparently, the program was effective, but they had no sense, the quote is, they had no sense of honor or loyalty, and the program was abruptly halted. Now, obviously, this could be, as I said, an urban legend. It's got a real kind of creepy pasta feel to it. I'm like, I'm not entirely buying
this
story.
I'm not buying this one at all.
Right? However, there are from multiple sources, even to modern times, of people experiencing truly terrifying things in this location. People saw, you know, entities that would wake up in the middle of the night to find an entity standing over the end of the bed. There would be ghostly forms that would be moving around. There was one particular soldier that was based there. His name was Martin Fox. I believe he was based there in the 1980s. And he claimed that he abruptly woke one night to find his bed levitating above the ground. Like, his face was almost up against the ceiling. And he thought that it was other soldiers playing a prank on him until he realized that the bed itself was actually hovering towards the ceiling, crashing down. There was another guy that claimed that he had heard jackboots moving through the halls. And one soldier even said that he'd looked out the window one evening to find a German panzer column moving along the road next to him in complete silence. He could just see it, and then it disappeared. So the other thing that comes out of this story is that official documents actually noted that this, because it had been converted into a barracks in the 1980s, that there had been an unexplainable spike in medical discharges and suicides. Apparently, psychological evaluations determined that the men were depressed, schizophrenic, suffering from acute anxiety conditions that were all brought about seemingly by some type of fear. The suicide rate was the highest amongst troops stationed here in Western Germany, and a medical examiner recorded that there seemed to be a dark, oppressive atmosphere over the site. Many of the soldiers that left recovered rather rapidly. So is it just the nature of this? Like, is it that some type of folkloric legend has grown out of this site? Or was it that some type of ritual actually was, not necessarily, you know, mutilating bodies, but perhaps, but was some type of ritual performed on this site? And this site was said to be, it wasn't just the architecture. This site was spiritually important. That's why they built it there. That's why they could enhance their rituals. And then it's left some type of doorway open, much like Aleister Crowley with the Abramelian meltdown.
Well, there's that new 900-page book from Stephen Flowers on Nazi occult mysticism. Have you read it yet?
No, I haven't brought myself to read it just yet. I thought I'd just give it a little bit of time before I got into that.
You're only halfway through.
Yeah, I mean, I'm two-thirds of the way through, so we might cover that, you know, later on. But yeah, look, take a look at the show notes, because I'll link to these books, I'll link to these reports. Make of it what you will. But I think that there is something about this. There is something very important about ritual. And, you know, you can't just dismiss ritual and say, well, it doesn't do anything. It clearly does something. But then to what, you know, lengths can ritual be used? I really don't know. But there are these stories that demonstrate that perhaps it can be used to contact something which is beyond our understanding. And once again, though, it never seems to be good. It always seems to be like this classic deal with the devil, where if you're going to mess with this stuff, ultimately it becomes dark. Ultimately, it wants something from you, and ultimately it ends badly for anyone that gets involved in it. So take a look in the show notes. Let me know what you think. And yeah, that's it.
Well, it depends what the will and the desire is. If the desire is for personal power and things to lust over and, you know, for money, fame, wealth and gain, then yeah, the outcome is often bad because they're selfish things that people are looking to gain material power and wealth.
Yes.
But so often rituals in the world, especially the traditional rituals throughout history, aren't those things.
They're to
honor the dead or to honor the gods or to honor your ancestors.
Yeah.
You know, these are...
Well, intention obviously plays a massive part.
Yeah.
You know, and you're right. That's actually a really important point to highlight. It's about the intention. Because you've got, though, like, you're right. There's like different funeral rites that are practiced and, you know, honoring the dead and, you know, preventing hungry ghosts from coming back, this kind of stuff. And then you've got people like John Dee. You know, John Dee, from what I've read about him, he actually appears to be a relatively good person, even though he was communicating with entities. But he was quite convinced that he was communicating with positive entities. It was always the angels. But we know also from many of these stories that these things that appear, they may try to manifest as appearing to be good, but they know how to trick people. They know how to pretend to be good when perhaps they're not. And this is why, you know, these people that, you know, mess with these things ultimately don't have a good outcome.
It all leads back to one man.
It's Crowley.
Aleister Crowley.
Yep.
And coming up in our Plus extension, you're going to find out how Aleister Crowley had a dark hold over the Beatles, how his influence extended beyond his death into the minds, into the souls, into the music of the world's most famous rock band.
I mean,
that's coming up in Plus after the break. I also might take a look at this Substack blog I've been looking at from Toby Campion. He's a really fantastic writer. He's been writing about Bruce Cathy's harmonic grid.
Oh, yes.
And Cathy's a really intriguing guy. He's a Kiwi, New Zealander. And I remember reading his books in high school, actually.
Yeah, we've got some of the copies here.
Yeah, harmonic grid I read in high school. But Cathy started to try and find patterns to UFO sightings across the world. And as he dug deeper and deeper and deeper, he eventually discovered what he believed was a kind of mathematical harmonic relationship between the UFO sightings across the world and a kind of grid that was traced upon the entire surface of the planet.
Did that power them? Was that the idea?
It was like a grid of energy where certain anomalous phenomena could take place.
Yeah.
I might go into that because Toby's been going through some of Cathy's kind of wild mathematics and actually finding that some cutting edge physics, some cutting edge mathematical theories may actually show that Cathy was right about some things. And Cathy also was very adamant that there was this secret network of antennas.
Antennas?
Yeah, there's this story, and I'll see if I got time for it, but there's this story from 1964 where this American ship was doing this sweep off the seabed of close to South America somewhere, and they found this strange-looking antenna on the bottom of the
that
sea.
It is weird. It looks like a bunch of jacks on top of each other.
It's at 13,500 feet. And as soon as people saw the photos, they believed, okay, this is clearly made by an intelligence. This is not something that's, just come out of the ocean. And Cathy in particular was convinced that this was a signaling antenna that was connected to the concept of the grid that he was starting to put together.
And then, signaling what?
Well, later, some more people got in touch with him and claimed that they were seeing similar antennas of a similar design, similar configuration on black sites all around the world.
Oh,
now,
okay.
Cathy goes into this idea that there was some kind of clandestine group that was using the idea, the discovery of this grid earlier in history, and he had just simply rediscovered it, that this secret society, this secret group was already using this alternate means of communication by using these strange antennas.
Is it so like a weird telepathy relay or something?
I don't know.
Okay. We'll have to find out.
You have to join Plus to find out. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. Sign up today. You get access to the big extensions we do on these shows every single Friday. And Plus members get an exclusive show every single Tuesday as well. And of course, when you're on Plus, you get a totally ad-free version of our podcasts. You get a higher quality version of the show as well. You get a higher bitrate feed exclusive to Plus. And if you sign up for MU Max, you get access to all the shows we've done for the, 12, 13, 14 years or whatever. Thousands of shows. That's what it feels like anyway.
It's in the thousands. It's, I don't know how many thousands, but it is probably
it's
there.
Nearly a thousand. Yeah. Sign up today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. $9 a month helps support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of the podcast. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Extension, great to have you.